Charm of Favor, Chapter 11.
Welcome back to Tripoli, Ambassador Stevens. My name is Aya. I will be taking care of your accommodations while you are here. I trust you had a pleasant trip, said Aya, reaching for his right hand with both of hers. It was smooth as glass. I'm glad to be back in Libya. Nice to meet you, said Chris. It is very hot this time of year. Make sure to drink plenty of water, said Aya. I won't forget. Ever since I was an exchange student in Spain back in 77, I almost passed out, he said, a little nervous in front of Aya's large brown eyes. The Middle East is a place of many dangers, Ambassador, said Aya, almost refusing to break her stare into his blue eyes. All people want to learn, and I think want peace, Aya. I taught English in Morocco, and the people there were marvelously curious. I fell in love with this part of the world. It feels like home to me, said Chris, finally looking around the large embassy foyer. Things have been rather tense since the president was killed, said Aya, beginning to walk down the hall toward the garden courtyard protected by the walls of the embassy. Rain was rare in Tripoli, but the sea breeze felt almost like San Diego weather. Open-air courtyards were common, but government buildings like embassies had to make sure there were no vantage points to see over the wall. This was now a country seething in controlled hostility. Yes, I left when the hostilities made it too unsafe for us. I'm anxious to get started. We need to know where we are so we can figure out where we're going, said Chris, trying to assert some leadership without really knowing what to say. I'm sure you will, Ambassador. Your government has been very active here for more than a year, said Aya with a straight smile and an almost imperceptible curtsy. You don't have to be defensive with me. I promise. I will do my best to help Libya transition to free elections, said Chris. That sounds nice. But the Libyan people had a president already they loved. I'm not sure they will know what to do with the right to choose another, said Aya, maintaining her quiet voice. Yes. Well, I understand that may be the case with some, but the State Department was aware of other things. The military was... I mean, our intelligence indicated that the people required our assistance, began Chris awkwardly. The rebels, as your American press called them, were outsiders. They were refugees and immigrants from other countries. They wanted the same benefits as Libyans, the housing, the oil income, the education, and the free medical care. The president told them this was reserved for the Libyan people, so they tried to take it by force. He was winning, until your jets began attacking the Libyan army. Who can withstand the American military? Asked Aya, letting her emotions show against her will. Is that how the people feel? Really? You know, I always wanted to be an ambassador. I guess I should be more careful what I wish for, said Chris, unscrewing the top from a bottle of water and taking a long drink. We are happy that you're here, but we are even more happy that you care about Libya, said Aya, tempering her tone back to a more diplomatic sound. It's okay. The truth is easier for me. I promise to be honest with you, if you will do the same, said Chris, twisting the top back on the water bottle. Yes, Mr. Ambassador, said Aya, again with a faint at subservience. Mr. Stevens is fine, Chris, when we're in private. I'm here to help, not to be your boss, said Chris. The first order of business was to assess the situation on the ground in Libya. Under the rule of the only president it had ever known for a generation, Libya had developed into a very cosmopolitan country. Gaddafi seemed to mature and develop into a man who shared the seemingly endless wealth of Libya with the people, but he was careful and experienced in leadership in the Middle East. It was still a place one did not eat a meal in front of the jackals. The appetite of the Libyan people was hard enough to satisfy without millions of refugees running to the smell of a free meal. Watching the small groups of mercenaries come and go was made much worse since 2009, when the U.S. State Department began hiring Al-Qaeda and even worse gangs to stir up trouble. The Libyan police were smart, difficult to bribe, and well-equipped to handle almost anything. But when the looting and armed robberies began to claim lives, Gaddafi sent in troops to gather up the outsiders and expel them from the country. As though part of the plan, reporters filmed from a script. Gaddafi knew it was only a matter of time before the footage would match the narrative being put forth by the U.S. Secretary of State. Reagan was tough and hit back hard when he was threatened. Hillary Clinton was treacherous as a desert wasp, and she had much bigger plans. Although opposed by almost everyone, she commissioned American and NATO jets to back up the mercenaries, and within a few months Gaddafi knew he could not win. They were trying to destroy the wealthy and peaceful empire he had learned to lead after 40 years of his share of mistakes. Once his army was scattered, the police were overwhelmed, and his guards were wiped out in a few hours. He called Hillary Clinton just before he left the palace and was assured safe passage. But within minutes of the call, the swarm immediately changed course and descended upon him like desert locusts. He ran into the streets and tried to blend into the people to make his escape. He had billions hidden all over the world, and he could always regroup in exile somewhere, anywhere. But that was not to be. As though he had a homing device on him, he was discovered, beaten, and shot to death in the streets by foreign mercenaries while the cameras rolled. Hillary laughed like a schoolgirl at a morning news program a short while after the assassination. "We came, we saw, he died." Killing Gaddafi was only a small part of the plan. Hillary's State Department directed the CIA to set up several stations inside Libya that not even the Pentagon knew existed. Its primary purpose was to make sure the armories full of modern missiles, rockets, grenades, and rifles were kept out of the hands of local warlords and preserved for delivery to the next phase of her plan. Al-Qaeda had the best fighters in the Middle East and Europe. They were well paid and loyal as long as the cash kept coming in. But Hillary needed something larger. She needed an army without using American troops and without telling Congress what she had planned. The DNC knew exactly what it was doing after all. If Hillary was president, she wouldn't be able to accomplish anything. Besides, she would never have been able to maintain her own off-site servers through which she ran the entire department without anyone looking over her shoulder. Within 2 years, she had accomplished everything the syndicate wanted. She had assassinated Gaddafi. She had sequestered enough weaponry to arm a sizable army. She had carefully embezzled nearly $5 billion from the State Department and had access to billions in cash on pallets in warehouses in the Netherlands. Numerous Saudi and Qatar sources had contributed money to the cause. It was time for phase two of the grand plan to secure control of a massive gas pipeline from the Golan Heights through Turkey to supply southern Europe. The control of this pipeline would ensure control over the entire southern European continent. Russia already controlled the supply of natural gas to northern and eastern Europe. But control of everything south of Estonia to the Mediterranean Sea would make the syndicate into the greatest superpower ever. Vladimir Putin was competing for the same control, but he had to make sure Assad remained in power long enough to get the pipeline through Syria. All Hillary had to do was remove Assad from power, and now she had freed up the weapons to feed the syndicate's brutal secret army. All that was needed was a reason to remove him. And that was exactly why the DNC wanted Hillary Clinton in the State Department and the smooth, untouchable Barack Obama in the White House. On October 21st, 2012, 3 months after Chris arrived in Tripoli, President Obama told the world that President Bashar al-Assad's use of chemicals against his people would cross a red line, after which America would use military action against him. The pieces were falling into place exactly as the syndicate had planned. The movement of weapons and chemicals from Libya to Syria would begin in 3 weeks. "Good morning, Aya. Did you send that email to State yesterday?" asked Chris. "Yes, Mr. Stevens." "Would you like some fresh grapefruit with that?" "We got some last night," asked Aya as she sat across the wooden table from him. Sure. I just wanted to know if anyone responded to the emails. I can't even go outside to jog. They threw rocks at our car again yesterday. My security people are telling me they only have sidearms. I mean, this is a War College 101 here. This country has no leadership, and they blame us," said Chris, sprinkling some pepper onto a soft-boiled egg. "Nothing so far, Mr. Stevens," said Aya, looking down at her coffee. "We're still scheduled to go to Benghazi tomorrow, right?" asked Chris. "Yes," she said quietly. "What do you think?" "This place is bad enough, but at least there's air support a couple of minutes away. I used to run this office a year ago, and I can tell you there's not enough security to make a remote meeting like that. We've recorded 21 incidents, and those are just the recorded ones." "I want to know what the hell State is doing to help," said Chris, stabbing his egg with a spoon to expose the steaming yolk. "The security officer keeps reporting they don't want the place to look too military. I'm not sure. Our local fruit market has more military than this place. If it wasn't for these walls, I don't know," said Aya, as her thoughts trailed off to a place she did not want to let Chris see from her. "Look, I'm used to resolving conflicts. I'm good at getting people to talk to one another. That's why I never practiced law. I retired my license back in 91. I wanted to solve the problems diplomatically, not through force or litigation. But this place has no law that anyone agrees on. There's no common ground between anyone," said Chris, almost unable to swallow the bite of egg. "Maybe the people will see you are not afraid to talk to them. You're a good person, Mr. Stevens. Sometimes it is better to talk peace when you don't have a gun," said Aya. "Oh, I get that. I don't even like guns. But the bad guys do, and I would like to see my family again. In fact, if I didn't believe in this mission so much, I would leave now," said Chris. "What is the mission? What is your mission?" asked Aya, now sending her Arabian eyes into his. "Well, you see, that's just it. I thought I knew. I had this idea of setting up elections here and getting some democracy going, but now I don't know. It's a mob mentality out there. In fact, it's a whole bunch of mobs, and that is the weakness of democracy. The biggest mob makes the rules, but the second and third biggest mobs don't like the rules, and then you have a civil war. I mean, Berkeley didn't teach me much else, but history was my thing. This is not going to work here. I want it to happen, but it seems like no one else wants it to happen," said Chris. "What does your State Department want?" asked Aya, trying to help. "You tell me. We have been writing and calling 10 times a day, but nothing has changed. Now they want me in Benghazi Monday. We have 5 days of meetings lined up over there. Do we even know what we're doing?" asked Chris, showing his frustration by laying his spoon down, unable to finish his egg. "You have your presentations ready. The cable only provided the appointments. You're meeting with the Turkish consul Tuesday night. I requested some talking points, but they just sent the same thing again," said Aya, waving her left hand over her glass of orange juice. "Do me a favor. I don't care that it's Sunday. Set up a call with State tonight. I want to talk to the secretary. enough of this bullshit. Either I get some answers, or I'm not going tomorrow, said Chris as he placed his napkin on the table and pushed back his chair to walk away. Aya watched him run his hand through his hair as he walked away. He had served in Libya twice previously as the deputy chief of mission from 2007 to 2009 and as special representative to the National Transitional Council from March of 2011 to November of 2011 during the Libyan Revolution. Through all of that, he never showed any fear. He always smiled, and his love for the Libyan people showed. His American accent was barely noticeable when he spoke Arabic, and that earned him great respect among the oldest Libyan families. But now there was a shadow on his back. He was afraid. The two-hour plane ride from Tripoli went smoothly over the light blue Mediterranean Sea along the northern coast of Libya. Aya and the staff were quiet, but Chris was unable to concentrate on the events of the next 5 days. The small group of SUVs was unmarked, and the local drivers and contractors were patient and helpful getting the luggage and things off the plane. Boubaker Habib was especially kind and stepped forward to shake Chris's hand and make him feel welcome. "My name is Boubaker Habib. We are so glad you could come. Anything you need, you just let me know," he said with his broad smile below his sincere eyes. "What name should I use? Is Habib okay? That means beloved, I think. Is that all right with you?" asked Chris, shaking his hand like he was climbing out of a stream about to take him away. He looked around the small airport. "Yes, yes, Mr. Ambassador, you are quite right. This is fine with me. Come in the vehicle where it is cool. My people will get your things. Hello, Aya. Good to see you again," said Habib. "Hello, Boubaker. Good to see you too," said Aya, shaking his hand and pulling her hijab against the sea breeze with her other hand. The ride from the airport to the compound was slow through the narrow streets of Benghazi. The traffic was thick and the buildings were close to one another. Suspicious glances bounced off the three vehicles that were nearly touching bumpers as they made their way to the walled residence that was converted into the embassy building. One of the gates was missing, and roads were in poor condition as they drove through the lightly guarded entrance, past the loosely saluting pair of men in khaki uniforms. The grass was dried, but alive, and the date palms looked parched and lonely along the driveway as they approached the flat-roofed building. The rooms inside had high ceilings and were decorated simply with cheap furniture. The largest room had been converted into a tactical operations room, and there was a safe room leading from that room that had been constructed with a jail cell-type gate that could be locked from the inside. Toward the rear of that room was a restroom with a private door. It had a small window near the ceiling. Habib's men brought the luggage in and set Chris's shoulder bag with his computer and documents along with his diary on the large wooden desk in the main office. Aya went out to the canteen-like kitchen and gave soft orders for water and some fresh-cut fruit to be brought into the office. "So, tell me, Habib, how are things here? Has anyone from state been here to set things up?" "Who's the security officer?" asked Chris as he unzipped his shoulder bag and began laying out his laptop and his papers. "Sean Smith is the information management officer, and Tyrone Woods is here as well. They're both former Navy SEALs. His crew has been making almost daily ventures out to find manpads and destroy them. Glenn Doherty is here also. All good men, Mr. Ambassador," said Habib. "All that's well and good. We've been sending emails and calls to state for upgraded security. Has anyone been here to audit the security? This isn't San Diego, you know," said Chris, trying his hardest not to lose his temper. "As far as I know, nothing, Mr. Ambassador. I have heard Sean almost every day on the phone, but there has been no support from the U.S. that I know of," said Habib. "I want a staff meeting for dinner. All hands. "When is our first meeting?" asked Chris, turning to Aya, who had just walked back into the operations room. "It is at 8 p.m. tomorrow. The Turkish consul wants to meet with you," said Aya. "Do we know why he is coming?" asked Chris, putting his hands on his hips and wanting to take off his jacket. He was in command of this facility now, but somehow he couldn't catch his breath. "He left no agenda, but said it was urgent that he speak with you," said Aya. "Mr. Ambassador, you should know that there is an annex less than 2 miles from here," said Habib finally. "A what?" "What annex?" asked Chris. "The CIA has an annex. There is a compound a little smaller than this one," said Habib. "The CIA? Why don't I know about this? What the hell is the CIA doing in Benghazi?" asked Chris, beginning to pace the room a little. "Why don't we settle in for a while? My people are watching everything. We will have a good meal and meet and talk. I am sure we can do some good here, now that you have arrived," said Habib, trying to calm Chris down. Chris took a few deep breaths and walked over to the tray with the water and fruit the serving staff had set down for them. He drank from a bottled water and broke off a small piece from the flatbread on the tray and took a small bite from it. He walked over to the barred window and looked out into the poorly trimmed courtyard and swallowed the dry bread down his almost convulsing throat. It was quiet outside, and somehow that was not comforting. "We're making that call to state tonight," said Chris, and the room was silent behind him. "Mr. Ambassador, my name is Tyrone Woods. I'm a contract officer in charge of security for the compound. My friends call me Ty," said Tyrone, walking in the room and firmly gripping Chris's hand. "Good to meet you. Just call me Chris between us. I'm trying to get my bearings still. So much has changed since I was in Libya last year," said Chris, sitting in the black chair behind his desk. "Yes, sir, no doubt," said Ty, standing at ease in front of the desk. "Have a seat, please. I just would like an update on the situation here," said Chris. "Yes, sir. I'd be happy to brief you. I have been here for a while. We're trying to track down ordnance, specifically shoulder-fired missiles, and decommission them. So far, we've found almost nothing. The locals aren't saying much. Too many mercs in the area," said Ty. "Mercenaries? I thought those were ours," said Chris. "Oh, they were last year. But these are imports. They've been coming in for weeks," said Ty. "What do you mean, weeks? Does State know? Has anyone talked to Clinton? Rice? Anyone?" asked Chris. "Oh, we've talked until we're blue in the face. I've sent more than 200 emails and maybe that many calls. Sean's the IMO. I know he has made some. I think the log shows about 600 in all," said Ty.
600 outgoing? What are they saying? What about AFRICOM?" asked Chris.
"They get copied on every email we send to State. General Ham is a good man. They're a little over 2 hours away by helo and less than that for a gunship. Other than that, I'm afraid it's just us. I don't feel good about it either. I've been with the military or on contract since I got out of high school, and I have never seen anything like this before," said Ty.
"Tell me about the CIA annex across town," said Chris flatly.
"I was going to ask you. They don't tell us anything, and I'm under orders to steer clear. They have their job, and we have ours. That's what my boss tells me," said Ty.
"What the hell are they doing here?" asked Chris.
"What the CIA always does. Something the Pentagon doesn't need to know," said Ty. "I'm here for 5 days of meetings. Then I'm going back to Tripoli. This place is not ready. It feels like a bomb ready to go off," said Chris.
"Yeah, I know what you mean. They shipped us a crate of surveillance cameras, but no tech guys to install them. They're still sitting right over there."
"We'll make it. We always do," said Ty. "Thanks for the briefing. I like it even less. See you at dinner." "I want to get to know everyone," said Chris, standing to shake Ty's hand.
"Yes, sir. See you at dinner," said Ty, He turned on his heel and began to walk down the hall toward the quarters area.
"And Tyrone?"
stopped Chris. "Yes, sir," asked Ty, pausing for a moment.
"Do you trust these security guys?" asked Chris.
"Not even to pump my gas," said Ty, and he walked out of the office. It seemed like days before dinner was ready. The roast chicken was delightful, and the hummus was the best he had tasted in a long time. Still, Chris didn't eat much. He was nervous and listened more than he talked while everyone ate and laughed as though they were trying to ignore a beggar in the room. Chris stood as the dessert was being placed and the plates were being removed. He always felt better when he was talking. "First of all, let me thank the kitchen staff for that wonderful meal. You know, the last time I was in Libya, I was learning the ropes. I don't know if I can do this job. I mean, putting this country back together is a hell of a mission, but I've committed to doing it if you will support me. I just want you to know how much I appreciate you being here." "Thank you all," said Chris as he sat down in his chair, not really feeling any better at all.
"Mr. Ambassador, on behalf of my team, I can tell you what it means to us to have you here. There is a lot going on, as you can tell, and the situation is kind of raw and primitive, but I think there is some good we can do here," said Sean Smith.
"Thank you, Sean. By the way, I want to place a call to State when we're done here. Those guys in D.C. should be up by now. We're going to get some support in here," said Chris.
"Yes, sir, you got it," said Sean.
The voices were quiet, and the sound of spoons against small porcelain bowls of ice cream echoed off the wooden floor and the painted concrete ceiling. The local staff took plates and glasses off the table and returned to the canteen outside the operations center. Chris, Ty, and Sean excused themselves politely and walked back to Chris's office and closed the door.
"Make that call," said Chris.
"Yes, sir," said Sean, as he began the series of numbers to make the secure satellite connection to the State Department.
"I want to talk to Hillary Clinton," said Chris.
"Good luck with that," said Ty, putting the tips of all his fingers together and flexing them like a spider doing sideways push-ups.
"You mean you guys have never spoken to her? This is her mess we're trying to clean up here," said Chris.
"Ha, no money in it," said Ty.
"What does that mean?" asked Chris.
"When was the last time you spoke to her?" asked Ty.
"When I was confirmed," said Chris.
"Not since, right? See, that place has been open for business for 3 years. And business is good," said Ty, moving his hands behind his neck.
"Are you talking about Libyan oil?" asked Chris.
"Hell no, I'm not talking about oil. I'm talking about weapons," said Ty, leaning forward and putting his hands on his knees, gripping them.
"Weapons? I thought you were here to destroy them," said Chris.
"Oh, I am. Why the hell do you think I haven't found any?" asked Ty.
"Hey, relax. I'm just trying to figure out what's going on around here," said Chris, wincing at not choosing the right words.
"I'm not without my opinion, if you want to hear it. Just say the word," said Ty.
"He's cool. All SEALs are that way. Comes from too much compressed air," said Sean, nodding that the call was connecting.
"Look who's talking, Frogman," said Ty, pointing and smiling at Sean.
"Frogmen never die," said Sean, smiling back.
"Put it on speaker and record it," said Chris.
"State Department, how may I direct your call?" came the female voice over the speakerphone.
"This is Ambassador Stevens in Benghazi, Libya. I need to speak to Hillary Clinton immediately," said Chris, leaning over the device in the middle of the conference table.
"One moment, please, while I transfer you," said the voice.
"Sir, you should not provide location information over the phone," said Sean.
"It's not encrypted?" asked Chris.
"The phone is encrypted, but that may not be the only device in the room," said Sean.
"You're saying the place is bugged?" asked Chris.
"All guns are loaded, Mr. Ambassador," said Ty. He's right. Who is the bullet and where is the gun? Said Sean.
State Department, how may I direct your call? Came a second female voice over the phone. This is Ambassador Stevens. It is a matter of great urgency that I speak with Hillary Clinton, please, said Chris to the woman on the speakerphone.
I'm afraid that is impossible. Secretary Clinton is tied up in meetings all day, said the voice.
Well, who can I talk to about immediate security needs for the embassy here in Libya? Asked Chris, as though he was asking which aisle paintbrushes could be found at the local hardware store.
I believe Eric Nordstrom is the regional security officer for your area. He's located in... began the voice.
Excuse me. Eric was stationed in Tripoli. He left in July. He knows very well what our needs are, and we have made now more than 600 requests for some help here. I need to know who is in charge of security for the Benghazi embassy, and I need to know right now, said Chris, raising his voice.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ambassador. I do not have that information, said the voice.
That doesn't surprise me. Get me the Deputy Assistant Secretary, said Chris.
I will put you through to Deputy Assistant Secretary Lamb.
Hold, please, said the voice, almost without changing tone. The phone made a beep every 10 seconds to let the party know they were still connected.
Deputy Assistant Secretary Lamb's office, how may I direct your call? Asked the young female voice.
This is Ambassador Stevens. I need to speak to Charlene on an urgent matter, said Chris.
I'm sorry, Ambassador Stevens. She is out of the office at this time. I would be happy to give her a message, said the receptionist.
When will she be back? Asked Chris.
I am sorry. I do not have that information, said the receptionist.
Okay. Make this message urgent and try to reach her as soon as we hang up. Tell her Ambassador Stevens is calling from Benghazi and requests immediate security assets deployed ASAP to this location, said Chris.
I will do that, Mr. Ambassador. Is there anything else? Asked the receptionist.
No. That's all I can take at one time. Thanks, said Chris, and he drew his hand across his neck so Sean would terminate the call.
Welcome to the U.S. State Department, said Ty.
What the hell is going on over there? Asked Chris, pulling his hand through his hair with his other hand on his hip.
I told you, business is good, said Ty.
I want to see Habib. Go find him for me, said Chris, waving his hand in frustration.
Tyrone left the room with the door open and returned in a few minutes with Brubaker Habib.
Yes, Mr. Ambassador, what can I get for you? Asked Habib.
Close the door.
I need you to tell me that your people have the perimeter secured, the gate and the courtyard. Are we going to be okay here? Asked Chris, trying to be calm and direct.
I picked them myself. My cousin is out there.
We know this area, Mr. Ambassador. We will keep you safe, said Habib.
Okay. Get some sleep. One eye open, okay? Asked Chris, putting his hand on Habib's shoulder.
Yes, Mr. Ambassador. See you in the morning.
You will see. Good night, sir,
said Habib as he backed through the open door and hastily left the command center outside the office. Tyrone slowly closed the door as Habib left through the other side of the operations room.
Not even to pump my gas, said Ty quietly.
Well, I guess that's it then. Let's get some sleep. Tomorrow we will try again.
We'll make a call to Tripoli tomorrow and see if we can get some support down here.
See you men in the morning, said Chris, sitting down at his desk.
Hang in there, Mr. Ambassador. We'll get you through this, said Glenn.
Yeah.
Thanks, said Chris quietly.
There was not much light in the city of Benghazi. Many houses did not have electricity, and the compound lighting was little more than a few floodlights on the corners of the roof lines.
The lack of modern vehicles in this part of Libby was also apparent, as the occasional vehicle driving the gravel and poorly paved roads could be heard for blocks. The skies were mostly clear this late at night, as the breeze changed direction and blew out to sea once the ground cooled off from the desert. Nearly every day, once it got hot, the high overcast sky or even a fog would come in from the sea less than a mile away. It was a calm body of water mostly, but like the region, widely considered to have been the cradle of civilization, it could rapidly turn violent and unpredictable. The night passed peacefully, and the dawn eased the feeling that wolves were napping not far from the door. "Good morning, Aya," said Chris as he walked into the dining room. The morning sun from the east lit up the room, making it feel more hospitable than the bare pastel concrete construction of the compound. "Good morning, Mr. Ambassador. There is fresh coffee on the cart and some sweet cakes, if you like," said Aya. "Sounds good. I didn't sleep too well." "New place," said Chris, pouring some goat's milk into his coffee. "There have been many budget cuts in the last couple of years," said Aya. "It doesn't make sense. I mean, the rebellion was not an easy time. It's going to take some serious attention to establish some stability," said Chris. "With respect, Mr. Ambassador, it was stable for the last 20 years. The Libyan people were doing just fine," said Aya. "That's above my pay grade, Aya. I'm going to do my best to help this country make a peaceful transition to a democratic form of government," said Chris. "You sound like one of those nice brochures," said Aya, taking a sip from her coffee. "All I know is that as long as people are talking, they aren't fighting," said Chris. "Yes. Tomorrow we start talking. Of course, don't forget the Turkish consul is coming tonight at 8, said Aya. "Oh, that reminds me. I want to call back Tripoli, Eric's old office. Maybe General Ham can spare a few people to help secure this place for the next couple of weeks, at least," said Chris, biting a small piece off the sweet yellow pastry and sipping some coffee. The brew was rich and strong, and it competed with the honey-sweet taste of the pastry. The strong flavor was one of the things he loved about the Middle East, the contrast between the bland desert landscape and the relentless spirit of the people was unique and intoxicating. Habib was attentive and polite that day, and Aya busied herself with getting the staff to make the compound clean and presentable for the next few days of visits. Ty and Glenn made numerous trips outside the city to follow up on leads as to where the enormous weapons cache might be. No calls or emails came back from the U.S. State Department addressing the urgent call Chris had made the night before. The ominous adversary made the strange abandon of the compound feel like a life raft 10 days at sea without a sign of rescue. The last afternoon shower washed the dust from his pores, but offered no solace to Chris as he shaved and let the last of the heater's energy soak into his shoulders. He missed his wife and resolved to write in his diary when he got dressed. The large black chair squeaked as he rocked in the quiet office as the dinner hour approached. He enjoyed writing in his diary by hand. It slowed his mind down to the speed of his writing and acted like a form of prayer. He reached with his prose for the reasons why he wanted to be an ambassador in the first place. Ever since his days at the War College, he felt like this was what he was born to be. He thought if he could make enough of a difference that one day he could bring his wife and family to Libya and let them fall in love with the history and potential of this country. Right now, that future seemed like another world and another part of the universe. There was a soft knock at the door, and it opened slightly to reveal one of Aya's large brown eyes. "Mr. Ambassador," floated her perfect accent to catch his attention. "Yes. Come in, Aya," said Chris. "I thought that we would have an early dinner in case you might want to get some air walking around the compound before our meeting tonight. It's really quite a beautiful afternoon outside," said Aya. You know, actually that sounds pretty good. I'll join you in a few minutes, said Chris. Aya walked out and left the door slightly open. He closed his diary and placed it squarely on the corner of the desk. He looked around and made sure everything was put away. He tapped some papers together and dropped them into a file drawer and turned the key to lock it. This was his. This was the center of the world right now. He felt his calling and took a deep breath and checked his tie to make sure the knot was centered in the collar that seemed to fit a little more loose since he left home. He wasn't used to having a long day without talking on the phone or jumping in cabs from one meeting to another around the busy city of Washington or the rush of demands of the office in Tripoli. Somehow he couldn't make his heart settle down. For a brief moment, he entertained the thought of getting on a plane and leaving the job he had worked his whole life to land. The dinner was peaceful, with just a few members of the staff present. He ate more than he had the night before and left the table feeling better. Perhaps it was just the jitters of an empty stomach and the lack of sleep that made him feel a little like going sailing alone in the bay near his home for a few hours. Mr. Ambassador, I just received a call from the consul's staff. He has landed at the airport and should be arriving a little early, if you don't mind making a little extra time for him, said Aya. That's fine. I'll be in my office. Just let me know when he arrives. Have you heard from Ty or Sean? Asked Chris. Sean is with Habib out by the gate, and Ty is on his way back. He should arrive any time now, said Aya. Tell them I want to see them when they get here, said Chris. Yes, Mr. Ambassador, said Aya. He tugged at his pants at the belt and made a small effort to tuck his shirt in a little more neatly and headed for the lavatory in the back of the safe room. He kept the toothbrush and mouthwash there, and the open window near the ceiling made it one of the more fresh interior spaces in this old building. Maybe it took a little longer than he thought, or maybe his mind wandered to a peaceful place. But when he merged, Ty was standing in the safe room loading a gun. Something I should know about? Asked Chris, wide-eyed. Just making sure the clips are full. It's a habit, more than anything. But I've been out on the city, and there's something going on, said Ty. What do you mean, something? Asked Chris as Glenn and Sean entered the room. I think we may have an issue, said Sean. That doesn't sound good. What's up? Asked Ty. Habib is having a hard time with his boys out there. They want to go home, said Sean. Home? What the hell does that mean? Asked Chris nervously. You can relax for now. I promised them double their pay for the next week. These people are all about the money. No sense of duty, I'll tell you that, said Sean. The Turkish consul called. He's on his way from the airport, said Chris. You could be damn sure they won't do anything as long as he is here. Turks don't put up with any bullshit, said Sean. They? What do you mean, they? Did you hear anything back from Washington? Asked Chris. Like I said before, there's no money in it. Those mercs that have been coming and going for weeks are nowhere to be found, said Ty, slamming a full clip into his 9mm and putting his holster on. Maybe they left. You ever think of that? Asked Chris. Hand me that FN. I'm going back out to the gate to make sure the Turk doesn't get spooked. Those guys like to see guns with the good guys, said Sean, ignoring the last question. All I can say is, make it last, Mr. Ambassador, said Ty, handing the Fen Phal automatic rifle to him and walking out the door behind Sean. I'll stay here with you, sir, said Glenn. The safe room was quiet as Chris stood there, feeling his heart come up in his throat. Glenn looked him in the eye. Mr. Ambassador, we're going to get through this. Maybe you're right. Those guys probably left town. This Turk may be a hitter, you know. He's here for a reason. And maybe these guys don't want to be seen in town right now. You go have your meeting. I'll be right by your side, said Glenn. Yeah, you're probably right. I guess they just want us to look like we're not scared of them, said Chris. They better be scared if they know what's good for them, said Glenn. Thanks, Glenn.
"You're a good man," said Chris as he patted him on the shoulder and walked out to the foyer to meet the consul. Chris and Glenn watched through the barred window of the Tactical Operations Center as two SUVs drove slowly through the gate and up to the entrance steps outside the embassy. Four men with weapons got out of the rear vehicle and began to look around the compound. They checked the hedges, the carport, and scanned the walls with their night vision goggles. One of them stood by the door behind the driver and reached to open it. The other three doors opened and the consul and two armed men emerged. The driver stayed behind the wheel. The two of them walked swiftly up the stairs and arrived at the front door just as Glenn opened it. "Come in, please," said Glenn. "Welcome to Benghazi. It's good to meet you," said Chris, extending his hand to the consul. "Good evening, Ambassador Stevens. My name is General Ali Said Akin. Thank you for making the time to see me," said the general. "Can I get you anything? Some water or juice, perhaps?" asked Chris with his diplomatic voice. "Water will be fine, sir." "Can we meet in your office, in private?" asked the general. "Of course, and our protocol officer, Mr. Doherty, will be there for your protection as well," said Chris. "Very well," said the general, staying close to Chris's side. The door closed, and his bodyguard stood by the door as Glenn walked over to the wall and stood quietly with his hands behind his back beside the window and watched the bodyguard. Chris poured two glasses of water and placed one of them on the edge of the desk and sat down behind his desk calmly. "Mr. Ambassador, I have come tonight to let you know we are aware of a plan to move weapons from Libya to Turkey. We think that your CIA is arming Al-Qaeda inside Syria, and it raises some serious concerns for us, as you might imagine," said the general. Chris took a sip of his water and found it difficult to swallow. He fought the urge to cough, to vomit. "May I ask how you came by this information?" asked Chris smoothly. "You are not informed, I can see that," said the general. "What makes you think our government has anything to do with arming Al-Qaeda? They are our enemy as well as yours," said Chris. "Not everyone in my government is in agreement with you and I, Mr. Ambassador. There is a war in Syria that your government wants to pay someone else to fight. The Wahhabis are not friends of mine, but I think this will not be acceptable to the Russians. We have enough trouble making a home for your NATO nuclear weapons." "We don't want trouble with the Russians any more than you do, Mr. Ambassador," said the general. "Are you sure of your information? Sometimes misinformation can sound so official," said Chris. His mind was racing to find a clue as to what General Akin was saying. Maybe this was why Clinton wasn't saying a word to him. Maybe this was why the Pentagon was not aware that the CIA had an annex in Benghazi. Maybe this was why Ty couldn't find the cache of weapons he was seeking. "Mr. Ambassador, I don't know if you are playing a game with me or if your government just sends you into harm's way without an idea in your head," said the general. "I just arrived from Washington a week ago. If this was going on, I would have been briefed by the U.S. State Department," said Chris more sternly. "I am not a diplomat, sir. I am a soldier. My information came at the cost of blood and pain. I assure you that your government is preparing a shipment of weapons by ship and plane to my country as we speak. Either you are a fool or a useful idiot, but you are in a serious situation. Time is not on your side," said the general. "Perhaps we can make some calls while you are here to clear this up. Can I interest you in some," began Chris. "I am sorry. I must refuse. My plane is running still at the airport. I would offer you a seat on it, but it is small and fast, and every seat is taken," said the general, looking Chris directly in the eye. "I understand. I would like very much to meet with you again when I can validate some of this information, if that is possible," said Chris. "If that is possible, of course, God willing. I must be going, Mr. Ambassador.
"Do take care of yourself," said the general as he stood and extended his open hand. Chris shook his hand and felt a shiver in the grip. Strange. He did not look old enough to have a tremor. He walked the two men to the door and his bodyguard opened it. The two SUVs were still running, and the men were still scanning the wall for any movement. They got in the vehicles quickly, and they drove smoothly around the circle drive and headed for the gate. Chris followed them with his eyes and noticed something near the gate as the taillights made the turn in the twilight toward the airport. It was a khaki uniform running toward the compound. Behind him was Sean, running with both hands on his rifle. 9:40 p.m. Unidentified gunmen launch an assault on the U.S. diplomatic compound in the eastern Libya city of Benghazi, quickly overwhelming the U.S. and Libyan forces who were providing security. Inside the compound, security forces are separated from U.S. Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens. U.S. personnel who retreat to another building come under siege for 2 hours before a CIA security team and sub-Libyan security forces repel the attackers. 10:30 p.m. Stevens and State Department Information Management Officer Sean Smith have taken refuge in the main building in the compound, behind a fortified door with metal bars that keeps the attackers from breaking in. But the militants set fire to the building. Within minutes, Stevens and Smith are overwhelmed by smoke. 11 p.m. A U.S. surveillance drone arrives over Benghazi. Then Defense Secretary Leon E. Panetta and General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, meet with President Obama. 1 a.m. A U.S. rescue team arrives in Benghazi from Tripoli, Libya's capital. Nearly 30 Americans are rescued from the compound. Shortly thereafter, Stevens is taken to Benghazi Medical Center and pronounced dead on arrival, according to a hospital source. A Libyan doctor tells the Associated Press that Stevens died of asphyxia, probably caused by smoke inhalation. 1:45 a.m. The Associated Press moves a news alert, reporting the death of at least one American in the Benghazi assault. 4 a.m. Gunmen launch an assault using mortars against the CIA annex. Glenn Doherty and Tyrone S. Woods, both former Navy SEALs, are killed. Two other Americans are wounded. 4:08 a.m. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton issues a statement. "I condemn in the strongest terms the attack on our mission in Benghazi today. The United States deplores any intentional effort to denigrate the religious beliefs of others. Our commitment to religious tolerance goes back to the very beginning of our nation. But let me be clear, there is never any justification for acts of violence of any kind." September 12, 2012. Obama announces that Stevens was among those killed in the Benghazi assault. In his statement, the president says, "I strongly condemn the outrageous attack on our diplomatic facility in Benghazi." His statement also says, "While the United States rejects efforts to denigrate the religious beliefs of others, we must all unequivocally oppose the kind of senseless violence that took the lives of these public servants." October of 2012. Ahmed Abu Katala, a senior leader of the Benghazi branch of the militant group Ansar al-Sharia, is identified as one of the ringleaders of the attack on the diplomatic mission. Although Ansar al-Sharia Libya was initially portrayed by some as purely a local jihadist group, it has been a part of the al-Qaeda network since its inception in 2011. The Long War Journal has documented the organization's ties to al-Qaeda and its branch in North Africa. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb on multiple occasions. In December of 2012, the FBI was granted only a few hours by the CIA to question al-Harzi, Ansar al-Sharia, Tunisia, actually stalked the FBI agents who questioned him and even posted the FBI agents' pictures on Facebook in an effort to facilitate their termination. They escaped with their lives. The following month, January 2013, a judge in Tunis ordered al-Harzi released. Senior Obama administration officials, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and John Brennan, who was about to become the head of the CIA, were asked about this during congressional testimony. Both of them vouched for al-Harzi's release. On January 23, 2013, Clinton testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. She told senators that the Tunisians had assured the United States that Harzi was under the monitoring of the court. Upon his release, I called the Tunisian Prime Minister. A few days later, Director Mueller met with the Tunisian Prime Minister, Clinton explained. She continued, "We have been assured that he is under the monitoring of the court. He was released because at that time," and Director Mueller and I spoke about this at some length, "there was not an ability for evidence to be presented yet that was capable of being presented in an open court. But the Tunisians have assured us that they are keeping an eye on him. I have no reason to believe he is not still in Tunis, but we are checking that all the time." During a separate hearing before House Committee on Foreign Affairs, then Congressman Tom Cotton asked Clinton if she found it distressing that the Tunisian government has released that gentleman, al-Harzi, in light of the hundreds of millions of dollars of aid we've given them over the last 2 years. Clinton responded, "At this point, Congressman, I do not for two reasons. First, I had a long conversation with high-ranking Tunisian officials about this, as did Director Mueller of the FBI when he was there in person. We have been assured that there was an effort to have rule of law, judicial process, sufficient evidence not yet available to be presented, but a very clear commitment made to us that they will be monitoring the whereabouts of the Harzi, and we're going to hold them to that and watch very carefully." Obviously, the Tunisian assurances didn't pan out. In fact, the Tunisian government accused al-Harzi of participating in the assassinations of two prominent politicians. One of them was killed on February 6, 2013, just weeks after al-Harzi was released, and al-Harzi was quite obviously able to travel from North Africa to the heart of the Middle East on behalf of the terrorist organizations he served. The Pentagon says he was working for the Islamic State at the time of his death. In February of 2013, Brennan echoed Clinton's claims regarding the evidence against al-Harzi. Brennan told Congress that the U.S. government didn't have anything at all on Harzi, and therefore his release was not worrisome. They claimed there wasn't sufficient evidence against Harzi, and that whatever they had wouldn't be admissible in court. They claimed he was not a threat to anyone. There are major problems with this claim. First, the initial evidence against al-Harzi came from his social media postings. This isn't the type of intelligence that needs to be excluded from court proceedings. Second, the U.S. government had enough on al-Harzi to have him detained in Turkey, deported to Tunisia, and then questioned by the FBI. To say, as Brennan did, that the U.S. government didn't have anything at all on al-Harzi is clearly a lie and meant to protect the syndicate's agent from being interrogated. Third, Ansar al-Sharia, Tunisia, was furious that al-Harzi was being detained. They ransacked the U.S. embassy in Tunis and demanded al-Harzi's release. The al-Harzi had direct ties to al-Qaeda's international network that was working directly for Hillary Clinton. Fourth, al-Harzi had already built a dossier of terrorist connections prior to the 9/11 attack, 9/11/2012. He had been detained and imprisoned for planning terrorist acts in 2005 in Tunisia, and his brother also was a known facilitator for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, demonstrating that jihadism was quite likely the family's business. The UN's official written designation page reads, Al-Harzi planned and perpetrated the attack against the consulate of the United States in Benghazi, Libya, on 11 September 2012. He was assassinated by an airstrike in June of 2015. According to the Pentagon, justice has finally been served in Ali Ani Al-Harzi's case. But we are left to wonder, why did it take so long? A key question in Al-Harzi's story remains unanswered. Why wasn't he in custody since late 2012? Because no one in the Clinton crime syndicate wanted him questioned. They also do not like loose ends. According to an initial September 14th report by the Times of London, the Libyan ship Al-Intisar was carrying 400 tons of cargo. Some of it was humanitarian, but also reportedly weapons, described by the report as the largest consignment of weapons ever seen from that country, headed for Syria's rebels on the front lines. This is the Libyan ship Al-Intisar, which is basically carrying weapons that are found in Libya, said Walid Farez, a Fox News Middle East and terrorism analyst. So the ship came all the way up to Iskenderun in Turkey. The ship was transporting aid material, but there were also weapons, lots of weapons. While the source of the weapons used to attack the consulate is part of an ongoing investigation, former CIA Director Porter Goss told Fox News, there was no question the weapons from Libya are making their way to Syria. The report also said that the U.S. intelligence community must be aware, given their presence in Benghazi. Absolutely. I think there's no question that there's a lot of networking going on. And of course we know it. A month after the October 2011 mercenary assassination of Gaddafi, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced in Tripoli that the U.S. was committing $40 million to help Libya secure and recover its weapons stockpiles. A few months after the attack on Benghazi, Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs Andrew Shapiro expressed strong concerns that the situation on the ground was far from under control. He told an assembly at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. on February 2nd, this raises the question, how many are still missing? The frank answer is, we don't know, and probably never will. Fox News military analyst Colonel David Hunt explained, the point is that these shoulder-fired weapons simply are extremely accurate and very simple to use. With a short amount of instruction, you've got somebody capable of taking down any aircraft, anywhere in the world. The Foundation for Human Rights and Freedoms and Humanitarian Relief was moving the weapons using first aid and food trucks from Turkey to Syria. The IHH disputed the claims and in published Turkish reports said it will take legal action against this article, which was written without concrete evidence. It is defamatory, includes false and unfair accusations, and it violates publishing ethics. No such lawsuit was ever filed. Serena Shim, an American war correspondent and journalist for Press TV, was murdered by a head-on collision with a cement truck for transmitting the proof which broke the story. The syndicate armed, funded, and provided intelligence to Al-Qaeda in Syria with the express purpose of removing Bashar al-Assad from power by any means necessary. There was more work to be done, however, before the world's most valuable gas pipeline could be routed from the vast reserves in the Golan Heights through Turkey to southern Europe. For that to happen,
leaders the syndicate had long prepared had to be placed in office.